There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, the podcast that is a roundup of our favourite bits from today's show, Brandy's birthday, Thursday, February the 20th.
Newsmakers.
The movers and shakers shaping your world.
Where Tom Urquhart, your newsmaker today, is a breakfast radio show presenter.
This is great. I don't know if you saw this story. You know how we were talking about the Brits yesterday? For those that don't know, the Brits is basically the British music industry's Oscars, if you like, where they honour British artists, but also international artists as well. So much revered event. With a couple of very high-profile parties afterwards as well. And so the great and the good of the music industry and also the music broadcast industry turn out to show face and do their bits and pieces, including Greg James. Now, those that don't know, Greg James is the host of the Radio 1, the BBC Radio 1 breakfast show. So think Chris Fade at Virgin, that's Greg James over in the UK with many millions of listeners on a morning basis. Much revered. It is obviously a role and a show and a job that a lot of very well-known individuals have had down the years. It's something of a career maker, if you like. Greg James has held on to that role for quite some time. Does he still hold on to the role? We'll wait and see around about 10:30 this morning. Why? Because at 6:30 yesterday morning, when Greg James was meant to be on air for his breakfast show, this happened.
Radio 1 Breakfast with Greg James.
Yeah, about that. Good morning, everybody. Hello there. Radio 1 Breakfast with Adele Roberts. I can't actually believe this is happening. Do you know, somebody actually tweeted my show and said, do you fancy doing an impromptu breakfast show? And I jokingly said, yeah. Well, here we are, everyone. Who's laughing now? Not me. Greg James is a no-show. A dirty little no-show. Has anybody seen it?
So he was called a dirty little no-show by his co-host, Adele Roberts, who'd been on air since 4 o'clock. She does the sort of 2 hours before as well. I had to then take one for the team and do the morning show.
To be fair, I've done that with you before.
I'm more than happy to do that. There's also his wife also tweeted saying, husband didn't come home last night. Any ideas? Ouch. Loads of pictures of him obviously celebrating himself at the awards and then straight afterwards as well. He surfaced round about midday. After yet more tweets from his wife saying, literally, seriously, has anyone got any information about my husband? If anyone's seen him, please do let me know. Then we sort of get a little update from him saying that he's been kidnapped. fans of his social media then start looking, go, no, you can't be kidnapped, because if you look in the background of the pictures he's posting, there's a padlock on the inside of the door rather than the outside of the door. Transpires that obviously he'd had a great night at the Brits, celebrated long into the wee small hours, and then was not fit for broadcast the following day. And then, just to ruin it all for everybody, it transpired later on, around about 6 o'clock last night, that it was all a hoax. It had been pre-planned.
Oh, you're joking.
Nope.
That's so disappointing.
I know. I'm switching off. Never listen to him again.
But genuinely, you and I have both covered for each other where we haven't been able to turn up, haven't we, for various reasons. You did it for me about 3 weeks ago.
No, I mean, if there are reasons, untoward reasons, travel, tired, emotional, anything, you know.
Rassel came in 2015, was
it? Tired and emotional.
Got lost on the way to work.
Absolute miracles low back in the gym room.
We're all human. My newsmaker is this guy.
Hi, guys. So we have reached 50 million on Instagram. It's quite surreal to know that so many people love and support me and they admire what I do. So yeah, I'm feeling very grateful, very thankful, and God's been kind, and thank you so much for all the love and support over so many years. I really, really appreciate it.
Sanooj Sharif with us in the studio, who, Sanooj, has reached 50 million followers on Instagram.
That's Virat Kohli, India's cricket team captain, reaching that landmark figure on Instagram.
It's quite an achievement. He's the first Indian to do it. Priyanka Chopra is like a whisker behind him on 49.5 million.
Yeah.
But he's the first Indian to get there. Narendra Modi, I think, is what, 35 million, the Prime Minister?
Around 35 million.
But Vira is up there. You've been crunching the numbers on just how much his fame and his celebrity, his Instagram followers are worth. He's a rich man, isn't he?
He is. His total net worth is around $25 million. That's as of last year, as of 2019, close to 100 million dirhams.
That's and 50 cents per per million followers, is it?
Around.
50 yeah. million followers, $35 yeah. million. Dollars.
Now also, you know, when you talk about his followers, he's got 50 million followers, but he only follows 148 people.
Okay, right. He's not reciprocating, is he?
He's not.
Do we think he's paid for his followers or are they legit?
We don't know, but, you know, we often hear that these people, they tend to buy followers, but don't know how that works and how to what extent it works. But he's got definitely 50 million plus followers now. The numbers are rising. And if you look at his brand valuation last year, that rose to $237 million. And he,
whoa, how much?
$237 million US dollars, his brand valuation. And that was a 40% rise from 2018. And this is according to the global advisory firm Duff & Phelps. They carried out the they do this research every year in terms of brand valuation of celebrities. And Virat Kohli's, there was a rise of close to 40% compared to the year before.
Well, Tom, I'm going to get your thoughts on whether you think he's worth it. But first of all, let's not forget, he's not just an Instagram influencer. He is one of the world's greatest sports people at the moment in any discipline. This is him scoring yet another century.
To Kohli. Smashed off middle stump. There's going to be two. And he comes back. For one of the best one-day international hundreds one can remember, a night he'll never forget, Virat Kohli has delivered.
As he always does. That was in Australia against Sri Lanka. I've lost count of how many centuries. Tom, where do we rank Virat Kohli? You're a sports fan, cricket fan. You played the game semi-professionally. Where does he rank in not just current sporting icons, but in the history of cricket?
Too early to say about the history of cricket, apart from what he's done for Indian cricket, is second to none in recent years. I mean, he's an extraordinary talent. Tell you what's extraordinary about him for me is the fact that he's able to captain and maintain these high standards. How often do we see world-class players who just lose their form as batsman, bowler or otherwise once they are given the role of captaincy? He seems to have thrived with that responsibility and that intensity in the role and continues to go on to do exactly that. So, no, he will go down as one of the greatest of all time because he keeps scoring. He keeps making runs left, right and centre.
20 seconds to both of you. Who would you pick in as captain and top batsman in your team at the moment if the team was playing for your kids? Would you pick him or Steve Smith?
Sanuj? I would pick Kohli.
Smith.
I'm an overseas citizen of India, so I'm going to go with Sanuj and go for Kohli. Thanks for that one.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Let's talk Expo 2020 Dubai. They and of course, one of their signature districts, District 2020, along with their Global Entrepreneur Programme, have recently launched Scale to Dubai. It plans on attracting innovative startups and small businesses that are looking to scale their business to the Middle East and the North Africa region. Tell us more about the programme and, of course, give us insight into how things are going at Expo 2020 and District 2020. We're joined by the director of the Global Entrepreneurs Programme, Tella Al-Ansari. Thanks so much indeed for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So the Scale to Dubai programme, taking innovative startups here in the region, giving them a global platform. How do you intend to scale those programmes for those particular startups? How's it going to happen?
So we spoke to many entrepreneurs and we understand the challenges that they face when they scale. So we designed a programme specifically to address their challenges, which provides them with multiple benefits. So the finalists in the program will get 2 years of free working space, visa, business setup, and most importantly, they will take advantage of being part of District 2020's innovation ecosystem. So they would be placed right next to Fortune 500 companies, academia, accelerators, and many more players as a part of our ecosystem.
Let's talk about the businesses themselves. Those that are out there listening in, that are tuning in this morning, they might have a startup. They might be looking at starting up before Expo 2020. Why should they get in touch with you guys? What benefits will they take from being part of this program?
So this program is tailored towards startups and small businesses, particularly that want to scale.
Yeah.
They should take advantage of the innovation ecosystem because it will really offer them immense opportunities to get a funnel of deal flow and to be part of focused innovation. So District 2020 focuses on four industries: logistics and transport, travel and tourism, construction and real estate, and education. And we also look at all technologies that support these industries. So if you're a player in the field of logistics and you're a startup and small business, you could be placed right next to Siemens that's going to have its logistics headquarters moved from Munich to Dubai in District 2020 as soon as the expo's over. So you can imagine the immense opportunities that would arise from that.
What about the benefits for District 2020, for Expo 2020, and more generally for the UAE economy? How are they going to benefit from this?
Sure. So Dubai's future plans are focused on basically having a diverse economy. And bringing in those global entrepreneurs will really help create a lot of jobs in the economy, because most jobs really come from businesses that are at the scale-up stage. And also bringing the most innovative startups out there would really help boost innovation in those four sectors, which Dubai is already a leader on and wants to continue focusing on as it, you know, moves towards its vision.
We get a lot of SMEs, startups coming here into the radio station, here onto the Business Breakfast, to talk about the challenges they face in the early days of trying to get their message across. I suppose this is going to be a truly unique platform, given the fact that the eyeballs of the world are going to be on Expo 2020 and District 2020.
Correct. So District 2020 is going to have a pavilion and presence during the Expo. And we're going to be running the Scale to Dubai Global Entrepreneur Program, where we will start screening and then shortlisting the finalists during the Expo. So the first benefit the finalists of this program would get would really be this recognition on a global platform that they've made it through to the program, that they're going to be part of Dubai's success story and future, and that they're part of this innovation ecosystem. I encourage all the entrepreneurs out there to really explore the benefits, take advantage of this opportunity, both local entrepreneurs and global ones, because we've got hundreds of opportunities available. So it's an ambitious program. We're going to have hundreds of entrepreneurs there, and we'd love to have them as part of our ecosystem.
And if people out there are listening in and going, yeah, that's got me written all over it, how do they go about getting in touch with you and your team?
Yeah, fantastic. So they should explore the District 2020 website. So district2020.ae. And then go to the Scale to Dubai tab and express their interest.
And just to wrap things up, all well on site at the moment? Looking forward to things?
All fantastic. You can follow our progress, go to the Expo social media pages, see all our videos, look into the progress through Google Maps as well. It's looking very exciting, and we can't wait to host the world.
Busy times indeed. Tala Al-Ansari, lovely to see you.
Thank you so much indeed for coming into the studio.
Have a lovely weekend. And of course, we'll have more news from Expo 2020 Dubai for you in the coming weeks.
Thanks.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Brandi Scott is in Mexico on what seems like the world's longest holiday. She's back in about 10 days' time. But before she went, she did an interview. We're going to hear from her now. People have been saying, we miss Brandi. So here you go. In response to that, this is an interview she did at the LitFest about a couple of weeks ago before she left with the author of the novels that became one of the world's biggest TV series.
I know you are an extraordinary person, exceptionally bright, determined. I know you're a psychopath.
You should never tell a psychopath you're a psychopath. It upsets them.
Are you upset?
That is Killing Eve. Luke Jennings is the author who wrote the novels. He was at the LitFest. Brandi moderated his session at the LitFest, and she sat down with him for an extended interview. And he began by telling Brandi how he came to write the Killing Eve series.
I was approached by Amazon originally, who were launching a series called Kindle Singles. And the idea behind this was that they were asking authors for stories that were not necessarily conventional length, that were shorter or possibly in some cases longer than the usual 150,000 word novel. I'd long had this idea in mind of Villanelle and her adventures. But I didn't particularly want to write it initially as a conventionally published book and wait 18 months before it came out. Because Amazon had said that they would publicise the stories, this seemed like a very good idea to me, because the problem with self-publishing is that nobody knows you've done it. But if Amazon were actually going to publicise these stories, then they seemed like a very good idea. That's where I originally launched the stories, and I wrote them quite deliberately, more or less the length of a TV episode, because I thought they would make good TV and I wanted them to come to the attention of TV people.
You were conventionally published, and very successfully so, award-wise, before that. What was it like, or what was the difference, working with Amazon as opposed to working with a conventional publisher?
There are two huge advantages. One is that a week after you've finished writing and written the end, there it is online. You're not waiting 18 months for a publisher to fit it into their schedule and all of that. The other thing is that you get immediately a good payment for each book. And again, straight away, because there are no costs to cover, then you go straight into royalties straight away. As I said before, the disadvantage of self-publishing is that it's a drop in the ocean. There are a million titles out there. There's no real quality control. I had the advantage that Amazon were publicising these stories. What actually happened was, I think they commissioned a lot of them, perhaps too many of them, of authors in the end. The result being that they couldn't publicise them all. And so by the time of the fourth story, there was no publicity forthcoming. I was having to do that myself. And no matter what people tell you, that's actually very difficult. Publishers and people will tell you, go on social media, promote your work there. Actually, if you use social media, like I use Twitter, there's nothing more annoying than people pushing their books at you. People don't like it. It's off-putting. So self-publishing it's a kind of double-edged thing. It gives you a lot of freedom, but you have to be very lucky.
And yet you did come to the attention of BBC America.
Well, what happened was I spoke to somebody who ran an actor's agency, and she read the first couple of stories and she really enjoyed them. Now, she shared an office with a TV producer, and essentially what happened was she walked the story across the office. The TV producer optioned the stories. And then it was some time later that BBC America came on board. Sky were the first people who were interested in the Killing Eve idea. There was a change of commissioning editors, and the editor who liked it left, and her successor decided to start with a clean slate. So that didn't happen. But BBC America stepped in not long afterwards.
And she asked him what the success of the TV series had meant for him as an author and for his financial freedom.
It's changed my professional life in that I'm now a full-time fiction writer. And before, I was dividing my time between writing fiction and journalism. I love doing journalism, but I just didn't have time to do everything. It's meant that I can write without having to constantly cut away and do other things. Not that I didn't enjoy those other things, but it's difficult to be a writer when you're living a very fractured professional life, going from project to project. So you never quite pick up running speed on any one thing.
Some people have called television the new patronage system for writers. How much of a difference does the war for content at the moment, with different streaming channels competing with each other to make their own series, what does that actually mean for writers?
Well, it is good for writers if you're writing what they want. I think that all the streaming channels now are taking a major interest in the output of fiction writers. I think it's a mistake for fiction writers to try and bend too much towards writing fiction. with an eye to adaptation, I don't think that really works. I think you have to write very much what you want to do without trying to lure all of these broadcasters in. But I think also a lot of these streaming video channels are getting very good at adapting fiction. In the case of the Killing Eve series, I think it has the spirit of the original while having all the advantages that television has to bring. The series is quite different from the novels, and I'm fine with that because I think it has to do what it has to do, and the demands of television are so different. I'm meanwhile continuing writing the novels, and actually the two coexist very happily in the same imaginative universe. They're very different, but they're complementary. The centre of it are these two fantastic actors, Jodie and Sandra, who are very true to character. And so because that central relationship is in place in the TV series, it's very much true to the spirit of the novels.
It's quite unusual to see a bloke writing a book that has two female protagonists, let alone two female protagonists who you could argue were occupying a bit of a male world, the traditional espionage novel.
I love thrillers, but I felt the genre got a bit stale, and I was getting a bit tired of those craggy male heroes. They're great, those books, but there are precious few laughs in there. They're a bit humourless. It wasn't my intention to kind of subvert the genre, but it did strike me that it would be very interesting to see what happens if you bring the style and the values of the male-led thriller. I was always an Ian Fleming fan. To a narrative with two female protagonists and bring that kind of pace that you associate with the male-led novel to a novel which was entirely framing two women. The male characters are there, obviously, in the books, but they are subsidiary, they're less important. The central two characters are Eve and Villanelle, unequivocally. And I think it works. This idea that female characters are more reflective, that kind of book has to be more interior. Well, I think they are interior in their way, but we judge these women by their actions. The pace is fast. What they do is important.
What next, then, for Killing Eve, both in terms of television and your books? How far can it go?
It's just been announced that a fourth TV series is to take place, and I've just finished the third book. And I originally foresaw it as a trilogy always. You know, I knew the story arc, really, of the three novels right from the beginning, and I've just completed the third one, so we'll see.
That's the author, Luke Jennings. He's the author of Killing Eve, which has been turned into a TV series. Bit of a bidding war for Killing Eve in this part of the world. Within the past 24 hours, we've heard that Wavo, part of OSN, has won the rights for Killing Eve Season 3. So, producer Shruti spoke to the guys at Wavo yesterday to find out why it's such a big deal. Noah Jadala is head of content at OSN's Wavo, and this is what she told Shruti.
Look, we got a lot of requests for the show last year. We brought it in after a fair amount of negotiations, and we managed to secure both season one and season two. A little bit delayed, of course, but we got it in, and we found that it did tremendously well for us. So for season three, we're really excited, and we're, of course, jumping right in, grabbing fresh episodes as they premiere in the US and in the UK.
That's Noah Jadala of Wavo.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
We're talking school fees, and they're only heading in one direction. Get down. That is the title of a report just out from Education Intelligence Group. Sean Robison, director, with us in the studio. Morning, Sean.
Good morning.
Good news for parents, bad news for investors in schools. What's the story?
It is good news for parents. As we've talked about already, parents have got choice across every aspect of the sector and curriculum. I don't necessarily think it's bad news for investors. I think the smart investors have already adjusted to the market. It does mean that you have to be agile and you have to know how to repurpose a school and pivot with different plans within the school, such as your staffing model. But those schools that are slow to cotton on will be suffering.
So a number of things to unpick there. Let's look at the headline finding. And literally, the report is just the word down repeated about four or five times on the cover. How much downward pressure is there on fees? Can you put a percentage on it? I know you mentioned in the report, getting data from schools is like getting blood out of a stone. But what do you know?
Well, yeah, what we know is that the premium and the premium plus segment, which is typically fees that start at around $45,000 for KG1 and then going up to, in some cases, $140,000, those schools have discounted between 10 and 15%, some 20%, but largely 10 and 15%. Talim have done a huge group discount, especially in their early years, or of around 10%, the second largest school group in the Emirate. So what's happened is those schools in the premium segment have discounted to become effectively mid-market schools. So there's a real pressure on the mid-market because the premium segment is suffering. Now, within the mid-market, you have fees that range from sort of 22 up to about 50 or 45 range, those schools are still typically doing well only if those schools are rated as good. The schools that are perhaps acceptable in mid-market, those are the ones that have lost students to other better rated schools.
Okay, so the premium sector is being squeezed. The mid-market for the good and above schools is okay. How are you defining affordable at the moment?
So I look at affordable schools from the sort of 30 to 35 down over range. You have some schools that are literally starting at 6,000, going up to around 20,000. But I typically look at it about 30 to 35 down over.
And how are they doing? Is that the sweet spot at the moment? Your report suggests that the economics, or the dynamics are better there.
The dynamics are better there. So we surveyed 3,000 parents, and the average fee range for those parents was 31 to 44. And the majority of those parents typically spend between 5 and 15% of their annual income on education. Those schools that have come into the market at that price point have enrolled the most amount of students in the past 2 years. You look at GEMS Founders Al Mizar, GEMS Founders Al Barsha, and Al Salam Community School. All of those schools have started with over 800 students.
You talk about some schools having to pivot, which is interesting. Pivot from what to what?
Well, this is just my personal opinion, a lot of schools are not agile in their teacher recruitment plans. So they often start out with very expensive plans to recruit from places where there's not a surplus of teachers looking. We've done a lot of research on teacher recruitment, and you can still recruit very good teachers from perhaps cities like Manchester, not a bad place, Newcastle, other parts of Northern England where there are surplus of teachers looking to move abroad, and likewise in other states in the US. So when I say pivot...
Yeah, but then you're going to have kids who end up sounding like me and you, because we're from the north of England. Which parent wants that?
I know, exactly. The reality is that there are more good teachers looking to move to the UAE than ever before.
Is that right? Because the story we've had over the past few years has been massive competition for particularly British curriculum qualified teachers, because it's the biggest curriculum in the private sector here. Massive competition, not from the UK, but from South Korea, from Singapore and Hong Kong, and of course China.
Yeah, I just don't buy it. In our Education Intelligence Group report that is out, there's an article in there which I've written, and it's called "It's on the Teacher Recruitment Crisis." And I originally put the headline "clickbait" because it's the ultimate clickbait article for principals to moan to say we're not getting good staff. But if you could go to a recruitment fair in London today, and you will see a surplus of teachers looking to come to the UAE, and likewise across the UK and the States as well. So I just simply don't believe it.
Lots of questions coming in. We'll get to those. We'll do one of them now, Tom.
This one from one of our listeners out there. Schools are struggling. Some of them have even started shutting down or closing their secondary schools. Could Sean comment on that? Is that something you're seeing?
I'm not aware of any secondary schools closing. I am aware in the past couple of years of one or two schools closing down.
Is that purely to do with numbers, do you think?
I think it's not just numbers. It's sometimes the owners, their equity investments into the school come from countries where they struggle to get money out, or there might be currency issues in those countries. So there have been a couple of cases like that where the owners just simply haven't had the working capital in the UAE to invest in the school, and the numbers haven't come through. So it's a number of problems that have just impacted on the school perhaps closing down. But I'm not aware of any secondary schools. But if a secondary school were to close down, it's generally because it's harder for schools to recruit children from sort of grade six or grade seven up over.
Do we still have that demographic imbalance? Traditionally, we did, a far higher proportion of kids in what we might call junior schools, kind of pre-age 11, simply because of the demographics of the parents that were coming to work here. Did we ever have that demographic imbalance? And if so, what's happened to it?
Yeah, we still have that demographic balance. It's still difficult to recruit secondary students for new schools, especially. Existing schools, they don't really struggle to recruit secondary students. But when you're a new school starting out and you're opening a brand new secondary school, you've got to convince the parents to sign up for your school without having any academic results to demonstrate that you can deliver in the most serious aspect of the school. So it's always a challenge for new schools to do that. But the problem gets even worse when, for example, the pound is weak and you can send your child to a really good boarding school for perhaps less than what you pay in Dubai.
Number of questions coming in. Omar writes in, there's been a rise in homeschooling because fees are too expensive for many parents in Dubai. Discuss.
I think homeschooling is a decision that parents take if their child has very specific needs. It could be that their child has is gifted in sport, for example, and has to travel quite a bit. It could be that their child has very specific learning needs. I do think more parents are choosing homeschooling, but it is a decision that is sort of outside of the outliers, if you like, of education because of the nature of doing the education at home.
Another question in, how many school openings are we going to see in Dubai over the next year?
I believe there will be three new schools opening in September, and I think the majority of them are in the mid-market segment.
Whereas a couple of years ago, it was, 15 or 20, wasn't it?
Yeah, a couple of years ago, it was around 15 schools, and only two were in the mid-market and affordable segment. The majority were premium schools. Let's not forget, schools take 2 to 2.5 years to plan, so it's quite difficult for someone to change their entire business plan overnight, and that's why we saw a sort of rush of premium schools, and only now are we seeing a trickle-down effect of different types of schools with different price points opening.
Rohit writes in, what are we seeing in terms of the changes in the curriculums of the schools that are opening?
So, yeah, I think the biggest change we're seeing is dual curriculums from the early years. So we saw a dual curriculum IB and UK from the early years last year. We're seeing other types of dual curriculum come in, and I think that's where school owners are seeing that parents have different needs and want a variety of curriculum in the same under the same roof. So I think we will continue to see those changes in the future.
What are we seeing in terms of, in particular, the Indian curriculum school? It is the largest expatriate population here, and it's for many, many years been a stalwart of the education system here.
We're seeing a lot of movement from the CBSE curriculum to the IB curriculum and the CBSE curriculum to the UK curriculum.
Really?
So that's where the biggest shifts are happening. And that's a lot to do with the parents' disgruntlement with the CBSE changes back in India, and also parents seeing the validity of the IB curriculum and how far it travels.
Very quickly, you say that the market here is perhaps saturated in Dubai and the UAE, but Saudi Arabia is a different story. You've just come back a few hours ago. You're just off a flight from Riyadh, aren't you?
Correct. We're seeing a lot of positive signs in Saudi Arabia. They seem to be very open for business and very open for different types of schools. We know that there's a lot of social changes happening in the kingdom. I think it can only be a positive sign for the region in general because it will make the UAE more competitive. And whereas before, perhaps the UAE had the was the place that the only place that people wanted to move to, and I think by Saudi Arabia opening up for business, it's going to make this region, this country, even stronger.
So it will make Saudi Arabia a more attractive place for an expatriate family to live.
Absolutely, and already they're inviting different types of schools, premium schools, school brands, mid-market schools, special educational needs schools. They're gearing up for a big population increase there of expatriates.
Announcement earlier on this week, Shawnee, from the KHDA and the Ministry of Education. Private schools cannot hike fees for the new academic year. You could hear the cheer. You could hear the cheer from here as parents all came together as that one popped into their inbox. But let's spin it on its head. How critical or how damning could that be for schools? So you talk about the two-year planning to get a school open as well. I'm assuming that a lot of these schools look at their bottom lines, they look at their financial plans moving forward. Could that hold schools back?
On the whole, no. And I know that schools will probably find my opinion quite unpopular, but the school groups are fine. They're generally fine because they have a lot of centralized resources. They can move resources around. So the freeze, yes, it's not great for investors. However, school groups can survive because they've got collective or cumulative margins across their school group. The schools that are standalone schools, not part of a group, and perhaps in the premium segment of the market, or perhaps in the mid-market segment, and they're not enrolling well, it's those schools that will find it difficult because they're just relying on one source of income, and their margin only comes from that. So on the whole, I don't think it's the end of the world for investors. What it does do, it signals to people who are looking to buy schools that perhaps there's a level of unpredictability in the market. But what we are seeing is that the deal rate in the UAE is up, which is a positive sign. It's a sign of a maturing market. So whereas greenfield projects might be not as busy as before, the deal rate is up, which means that more investment from outside is coming in to sort of mature the market in a different way.
Sean, we'll have to leave it there. Fascinating discussion, as always. Appreciate you joining us with your new report today. That is Sean Robison of the Education Intelligence Group. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcast at DubaiEye1038.com.